Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest on this Labor Day here in the United States, where it is, I'm not saying this to make everybody else on the earth who listens around the world to make you feel bad that we have a day off and you don't, but I'm just saying we have a day off. That's all. I'm just, how you feel about it, that's your business. I'm not gloating. I'm just saying for us, it's a day off. We can do whatever we want, and we're probably eating hot dogs, which... That's the true American
food.
That's
always a safe
bet. It's always, yeah, somewhere, someone in America is eating a hot dog right now. Maybe some corn on the cob. What else are we eating today, Joe? Crab cakes?
I'm in Kansas City, so we're doing ribs. Oh, we're going to be doing bratwurst. It's going to be delicious. It might already be delicious. I mean, this is not live.
Yeah, so.
I'm one of those people who like would overthink. You know, back when answering machine messages were a much bigger thing?
Like when they were a thing? when they were a much bigger thing?
Like when you would not have your phone with you at all times and would actually have calls go.
You get to push the button when you go, there would be a little flashing light. And you'd be like, oh, I got a message. Somebody cares about me. Yeah.
So like the whole idea of leaving an outgoing message where I'm like, hi, I'm not here right now. But I'm like, but I am. I'm leaving this message. I would overthink that anyway. So all I'm saying is to do Catholic Answers Live, not live, and be like, yeah, I'm eating hot dogs right now. It's like a time travel paradox.
Yeah, I totally get it. I also am. It's constantly reinforced to me that very highly intelligent people are also weirdos.
I think that's an unrelated point, though, right?
Well, I don't know. That's a completely related point.
You're like, I'm just reminded of this for some reason.
By the way, I will probably give out the phone number. I do that. I make mistakes. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things I believe I might be known for. That might be one of the things that he makes a lot of mistakes. But all of the questions are already in for the next hour. We have our main giving society here, which Michelle runs, and she's brilliant. She does a great job at it. And if you join, she'll make sure you get all kinds of cool stuff for joining. And one of the things that she does is she arranges this show for us. And this is something I love about Catholic Answers, that there are people here who are faithful, wonderful, and incredibly confident people. I mean, competent people like Michelle that nobody ever hears about the work that they do. But they're like, Michelle's really good at her job. I don't even know if you know that, Joe, but she's very good
her
job. But anyway, I don't know why I'm talking about that. Just go to Society 315 if you'd like to be a member. And all the questions today are from Society 315. And some of them are via video, and this one's via video. This one comes from Amy. Amy, we're grateful that you are a supporter. Thank you for that. And what do you got to say?
Hi, Cy and Joe. It's Amy David, fellow cruiser from the Catholic Answers cruise earlier this summer. My question concerns religious orders for men and women. Are there a restricted number of orders that have been formed or can be formed? What do the initials mean after a lot of the religious names that I see after reading something by someone from a religious order? And can you recommend a resource to demystify all the different orders and what they mean? That would be appreciated. Thank you both for your apostolate. You're making a difference. Well.
Yeah.
That was nice. You didn't get to see when she came on the screen. I recognized you. We just went through Canada with her on cruise. She's like this.
That time I was able to see her. I don't know
you could
why.
See, oh, they show you.
Yeah.
Know,
I'm as mystified by the way any of this technology works as anyone. But I was able to see her, and yes, I recognized her right away.
Yeah, yeah.
Both her look and her voice. And then she explained who she was, but I already knew.
I'm so proud of you, Joe. Again, highly intelligent, a little weird. Your response there.
I am terrible.
I'm not talking about her. I'm talking about you.
No. She's highly intelligent.
No, but not a little weird.
I don't know why you say that. Well,
no, she's like a big, I know this about her, and she's like a big corporate bigwig. Like, she's like one of those people that like can do stuff. Not like us, Joe. She's one of those people that can do stuff. But you were about to say, I apologize.
Yes, there's a whole section of canon law that talks about creating what are called religious institutes. So you have what are called institutes of consecrated life, as well as societies of apostolic life. So I'm not going to get into all of the canonical distinctions, but suffice it to say, some things are under the auspices of the bishop, And some religious communities directly kind of report to the Pope. And there's different ways those get canonically set up, and you can go from being more local to international. You also have differences in terms of whether you have something like a cloistered community as opposed to a community that's out in the world. You will have different canonical setups for even like public associations of the faithful, where like the laity can come together and do things. So you have all these different kind of canonical orders. And so everything is kind of set up in an orderly sort of structured way for a pretty simple reason. You don't want people just going around creating ministries in the name of the church that may not be spiritually healthy, may not be built on good theological principles and the like. The church is looking for whether there's an authentic spiritual need that's being responded to, whether you have a good kind of basis. So there's not a set number that can be approved, but it is rather more of something like a case-by-case approval. There's certain things that are required. For instance, a religious community in Canon 608 must live in a legitimately established house under the authority of a superior designated according to the norm of the law. Each house is to have at least an oratory in which the Eucharist is to be celebrated and reserved so that it is truly the center of the community. That's on a religious institute. So you have plenty of rules kind of like that to make sure you're centered around Jesus Christ, centered around the Eucharist, in union with the Pope, in union with the whole Catholic Church, not teaching something antithetical. My favorite example of the kind of the church's discernment in this is from the pontificate of Pope Innocent III from 1198 to 1216, in which three different communities wanted to be recognized as new religious orders: the Franciscans, the Dominicans, and the Waldensians. Chances are you've heard of the first two of those three, which were approved by the church. The third one, if you've heard of them, it's because they broke off and became kind of early Protestants, because they rejected the Pope's authority when he wouldn't agree with them. Their radical view on property and everything else was too far. It was not sufficiently Christian. It was not sufficiently Catholic. And they were teaching heresy. And they had this radical love of poverty that the Franciscans did, but they didn't have this tempered by kind of good theology. That's one of many kind of areas where they proved very controversial early on. And so they end up going off the rails spiritually and becoming schismatics. And so it shows that the church has this really important role to play. You don't want to just say, oh, these people are well-intended. They're really, you know, zealous and on fire. Because well-intended, zealous, on fire people can do a lot of good or can do a lot of damage. And so the church has this role of saying yay or nay and helping to regulate. Also, when often what happens with the religious community is there's some really brilliant, holy, charismatic founder who does a great job, and then they die, and then the community can fall apart very quickly because the next generation has different ideas of what to do next, and there's nobody who can kind of fill those shoes in the same way. Those kind of things. So the church has an important role to play. What if you have that happen with a community? Maybe you're helping to run several churches. Maybe you have a religious house, and the question becomes, what should happen to this property? What should happen to the spiritual care of the people who are going to these churches? All of those kind of hairy questions can come in. So the church has this really important role to play, but not in the sense of saying we're only allowed to have 200 orders. And so, you know, if you're going to become one, somebody else has to leave. In terms of the other question, in terms of the letters, these are post-nominal letters, meaning a fancy term for letters after a person's name. So you get like Father Fessio, S.J. S.J. means Society of Jesus. That's the technical name for the Jesuits. Jesuits, the Jesu and Jesuit comes from Jesus. Or you have the Dominicans. Their technical name is the Order of Preachers. We call them Dominicans because St. Dominic founded them. He didn't actually name them after himself. He named them the Order of Preachers. So you'll see OP after their name. The Franciscans are the Orders of Friars Minor. So OFM is what you'll see after their names. And then there's several other smaller orders that have different names as well. And they're often just an acronym for the order. So on the smaller ones, it's often case by case. You might say like, oh, OMI, the Oblates of Mary Immaculata, or I think that's what it is. And then, so you have the smaller communities have letters as well, but those ones are less well known.
Like the Oblates of St. Joseph. I don't want to say
yeah.
Because our good friend, Father Matthew Spencer, is a guest on here, and it's a small order. So I thought, while you're mentioning them, I'll just mention the Oblates of St. Joseph, a wonderful community of priests. And if you're thinking about being a priest, you can check out the Oblates of St. Joseph at osjusa.org.
Nice.
See, if you're going to be a guest on this show, you're going to get some benefits from it. So there you go, Father Matthew. All right, Amy, thank you very much. It was really cool traveling through Canada with you and your husband. And thank you very much for the question. And thank you for the support. We really appreciate that. I better take a break. We'll be right back with more, what do we call it? Society 315 Open Forum. Is that right? Yeah.
Yes.
But even though
yeah.
it's, I know, I'm now doing this.
Not so live.
Right. I'm doing the Joe Heschmeyer overthinking it thing now. Well, it's a closed forum because all the questions are already in, but it was open at a certain point. All right, mm-hmm. I'm going to work my way through this conundrum. We'll be right back on Catholic Answers Live.
Your questions, Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Carry the faith wherever you go. Catch up with the latest news from Washington, D.C., the Vatican, and the world on all of our EWTN news platforms, such as the National Catholic Register, Catholic News Agency, EWTN News Nightly, EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, and EWTN News In-Depth. Download the EWTN app at EWTNapps.com today.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest, all the questions in from our Society 315, our giving society here at Catholic Answers. Lots of great questions so far, lots more great ones to come. This one comes from Lance. Lance, thank you for your support. In the book of Acts, Paul confronts Peter regarding Peter's refusal to eat with the Gentile believers. If the Pope makes a similar error today, who confronts him and how is it done?
Yes, this is what's sometimes called filial correction. This is so, and I think that's a good way of framing it, that when we talk about correcting the Pope or even correcting your bishop, you should think about it in the way that a child would think about when and how to correct their parents. There may be times that your parents are doing something, you know, gravely immoral, and you as a child, even a minor child, have a moral duty to speak out and say, Mom, Dad, you shouldn't be doing this. You know, let's stop robbing banks as a family. This is not how we're going to finance our trips to Disney World anymore.
Getting a little close to home on that one, but all right.
I mean, I'll let the emails come in. I'm going to forward them to the FBI. No. So the idea is, while those situations may arise, if you found yourself habitually correcting your parents, if I sound like I'm laughing here, it's because I just thought about the fact that my children do this over little things. I'll say, Jimmy, get your pants on. And he'll say, they're not pants, Dad, they're shorts. You knew what I was trying to say. I have no idea where he gets it.
yeah, where could that come from?
I know. Pedant? I'm shocked. And so then my wife looks at me like, you deserve this. But the point is, if you're like morally correcting your parents all the time, that's actually a sign something is gravely wrong. And it's easy to say, oh, yeah, something's gravely wrong with them. But chances are actually pretty good. You're just not being a good son or a good daughter. That you are not receiving. You're trying to lead when you should be following. And I would say the same thing with regard to the church, with regard to the Pope. It's not that we can never say anything. St. Thomas Aquinas talks about how we might even publicly correct the Pope. And in fact, I would say canon law says this as well. Canon 212, section 3, says, according to the knowledge, competence, and prestige which they possess, they have the right, this is a faithful, and even at times the duty to manifest to the sacred pastors their opinions on matters which pertain to the good of the church and to make their opinion known to the rest of the Christian faithful, without prejudice to the integrity of faith and morals, with reverence toward their pastors, and attentive to common advantage and the dignity of persons. So what does that mean? It means sometimes you can speak up, and you can do that in two ways. You can talk to the person themselves, and at times you can even make your opinions known publicly on these things. That should not be every time. If you think about Matthew 18, if you see your brother sinning, you go to him privately first. And then if he won't listen to you, you bring one or two with you. You don't start by blasting him on social media. You don't begin by publicly denouncing. We have forgotten this as Christians. And I think as Catholics, we are pretty guilty of this. You can get 100,000 views on Facebook by just denouncing the Pope as a Catholic on any number of issues under the sun. And I think we need to be very spiritually cautious about this, because I'd say two things. Number one, it's not likely to actually improve anything in the church. So if we are attentive to common advantage, like we're called to be, what good are we actually doing there? Is the Pope following your channel, and is he going to like do things your way? Probably not. And number two, you can actually lead to a great deal of spiritual detriment. Jesus talks about the good of the church being one for the sake of the gospel. I'd read John 17, verse 20 to 23. One of the reasons for the oneness of the church is so that the world may believe the Father has sent the Son. If Christians are constantly fighting with each other, if Catholics are fighting against each other constantly, that is a deterrent to anyone who is not a Catholic or is not a Christian to convert. And so we need to be very mindful, not just, can I prove that I'm technically right and somebody else is technically wrong, but is this an important enough issue to cause a big fight? In the same way that, if you're at dinner and your spouse gets a detail in a story wrong, should you publicly rebuke and correct her? Probably not. That's a good thing for the car ride home. So you can be no, I'm just kidding. Don't even do it. there are times where you hold your tongue for the sake of the peace. And not if somebody's like soul's endangered or threatened or anything like that. So the catechism, the Code of Canon Law acknowledges that there are times you have the right and even the duty to say something, even about a superior. But you should be doing that charitably and very mindfully, including being mindful of your own level of knowledge, competence, and prestige. Are you actually an expert in the area that you're wanting to rebuke them on? If you're not, maybe you instead ask somebody who knows the situation better what their thoughts are, and maybe they have a duty to say something, and you have a duty to hold your tongue. And then St. Thomas Aquinas, as I was starting to say, talks about this as well in the second part of the second part, question 33, where you may at times be called to correct your superior in the church, but you should do it not with impudence and harshness, but with gentleness and respect. And he points to St. Paul in this account from Galatians 2 as an example for that. And that this is something to do if the faith is endangered. That would be the kind of situation which you would speak out publicly. If, let's say, your bishop is saying something totally false on a moral teaching, well, then the need for kind of keeping a unified front, the need for just being respectful and all of that is counterbalanced by the need to speak out boldly about a false doctrine. And you still want to do it in a respectful, charitable way. You still want to remember you're not the bishop, but you may have a duty to speak out in those kind of situations. So I know I keep saying there's this, but there's the opposite. There's this, but the opposite. That's because some people are of the view that like we should never say anything ever. And that's not what the church has ever taught. And other people are of the view that like we should speak out all the time on everything. And that is not what the church teaches. That's not what Jesus teaches. The truth is more nuanced than that, and I wish more Catholics would appreciate that nuance rather than flying to one of the two extremes.
Thank you very much for the question. An excellent question. It does. We started the show last hour. You talked about the labor situation has changed with the dawn of AI and globalism and all that. I feel like the communicating corrections to the church situation has changed because there's so much indirect communication now. There's so many that we have not grappled with the morality of, should I be putting this on, Twitter about my bishop or some other bishop or the Pope, or should I be like this? There's a lot of means of indirect communication.
Yeah,
to say things that you should actually be circumspect about, even whether you should say those directly. But it's almost like we lowered the standard rather than raising the standard with this indirect communication.
Some people listening are going to be too young to know this, but when social media first came out, it was for taking pictures of your food and talking about your feelings. It wasn't for commenting on every story under the sun. And somewhere maybe 10 years ago or so, it switched where it became sort of the norm for people to comment on everything and to even feel a sort of pressure like, well, everybody else is talking about this issue. I should probably, you know, talk about that Australian breakdancer. I need to get my 2 cents in. And it's like, no, you don't. You don't. There's no need to do that. The world will be fine without you adding your 2 cents of uninformed opinion on the latest social issue, on the latest news story. And that includes both things in the church and things in the world more broadly. Like, we have become a whole class of commentators, yeah, which is totally bizarre.
Yeah. Everybody is all of a sudden what, you know, H.L. Mencken was 100 years ago. You know, there's like one smart aleck, yeah, guy making nasty comments about everybody. Now everybody is that guy.
And I mean, I say this as a smart aleck, but I try not to opine on, yeah, on most current events sort of things. I try to actually hold my tongue in terms of like publicly speaking out on my thoughts on politics or anything that isn't the gospel of Jesus Christ and his church. And the Chiefs.
Oh. Yeah, those. I know how that. Yes, I've been at the wrong end of some of your Chiefs comments. But yeah, I'm glad to have a little moment to discuss it with you because I do think there's the technology itself or the way we've arranged the technology has somehow convinced us that it's okay to say things that we absolutely should not be saying or to support people who are. Give our thumbs up to somebody who says some nasty thing. And maybe very well, possibly this bishop or the Pope or whoever might benefit from that correction if, you know, in some way. Like, okay, people are not perfect, but that doesn't mean that you should have done that on Twitter or on your podcast, right, or whatever. And sometimes...
Yeah, I had a very positive experience recently. I'm going to be intentionally vague on the details, but I was... giving a talk at a Legatus event, and I was staying with a deacon, and it was in a diocese where he has a very controversial bishop, and so here he is, part of the clergy, and I asked, you know, how things were going in the diocese, something kind of open-ended, and he was very delicate. He's like, what have you heard about, like, our diocese, yeah, or about the bishop? You know, he didn't like jump in with a bunch of complaints. He sort of felt out what I already knew. And then sort of expressing, oh, yeah, you know, this is kind of tough. But he was very gracious about it. You know, he was so good about not just bashing and being nasty and all of that in a way that was really kind of refreshing. He didn't hide from the fact that his bishop had said some stuff that he had made national news in a negative way. but it had been pretty recent by the time I was visiting. But he also didn't just, like, join in the bandwagon kind of bashing on the bishop, because to what end? What would that have done?
What
would that have helped?
Yeah. And I have to say, Joe, you go out and speak more than I do, but I get out, you know, to parishes and events a good amount. It's very rare that there's not some people who will come up to me and say, I'm just so upset about what's going on in the church. What am I supposed to do? I mean, there is a point at which we have to ask ourselves, are we part of making lots of people upset? And I know I have been. I have said things I shouldn't have said. I have copped an attitude when I should have been humble. But, you know, there's an industry now of upsetting people. What is this accomplishing? What's the point of all that?
I'll say what I've tried to do. I don't know how successfully. Like, I try to, when there's a legitimate issue that comes up and it's public, so I'm not going to be like the one breaking the news, I want to validate when people are troubled by something or,
sure,
yeah, like kind of shocked by, oh, that seems like that was not the right thing to say or do in that situation. To be like, yeah, I agree. I see where you're coming from. I think that you might be right about that. But then to also be like, and that doesn't threaten my being Catholic. That none of the Catholic, like, to be Catholic, you don't have to think that was the right way of responding. And so my hope there is that I'm not just making people angrier, but it's actually, I'm trying to give a little bit of peace, not the kind of false peace of saying, oh, yeah, there are no problems, because that's not true. But a true piece of saying, yeah, even in the midst of problems, Christ is king. The gates of hell won't overcome the church. He's still in control of things, even if you don't like who your bishop is, even if you don't like who the pope is. That's not going to be the thing that makes or breaks whether the Catholic Church survives. That this is something that's in God's hands, not in our hands. And if we lose sight of that, if you become focused on the church politics or the latest scandal or any of those things, you can actually lose sight of who's really in control of the church.
And you also lose sight of that you still have a vocation to be charitable and loving. And if you're upset all the time, you're not going to do it. You've got to stop doing that, or you're morally culpable for the love and the kindness you didn't share in the world. We'll take a
break.
There were
great saints in a period of church turmoil. Okay, sorry.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to casociety315.com and join today.
As we read the Gospels, every Christian faces the question again and again, what does Jesus mean? Getting the answer right is critical to both growth in holiness and fruitful evangelization. Want to know Jesus better so you can introduce him to your friends? Then it's time to get serious about understanding his words. Why not join Catholic Answers for our 10th annual Apologetics Conference? Learn from me the parables, sermons, and conversations of Jesus Christ. September 26th through 29th, right here in sunny San Diego. Learn from our guests, Dr. Scott Hahn and Kimberly Hahn, Dr. Ray Guarendi, Father Sebastian Walsh, Billy Junker, Father Paul Check, and, of course, all of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. It'll be 4 days of fun, faith, fellowship, and a live radio show. Seats are still available, but going fast, visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 1-888-291-8000 today.
I think Darren's just in a summer mood. He's given us, on a Monday, he's given us groovy music. So I think he's just trying to have a little last enjoyment of summer, get a little groovy before we got to go back to work or back to school. It used to be you. I don't even know if you're this age, Joe. When I was a kid, Labor Day, then the first day of school. That's how it was, so simple. Everybody in the whole country, you just had Labor Day. Then the next day you went back to school.
This is what my children are doing. My daughter's already back. My son goes back tomorrow. And wife was like, they're starting so late. And I'm like, no, they're starting at the proper time. I think she's just ready.
But this is one of this. I have a little bee in my bonnet about, which is I don't think children today get enough time to just goof off. There's too much structure in their lives. And I don't mean that because I think children, you know, yes, they should learn math and science and all that stuff, but who is learning math and science? Is there a person there, or is it just a machine that's learning? If it's going to be a person, you need to just let them roam free for the month of August. They should be free range August. That's going to be my new bumper sticker, free range August.
What we had for our August. Yeah. My kids are both, the two oldest ones are in a 3 to 6 year old Montessori class. So school is really a fancy term for, if you've ever experienced Montessori, it's just like...
It's like being free range,
self-directed learning play. I mean, my daughter tells me what she did, and I'm like, that sounds pretty fun. I think I kind of want to go to Montessori.
Yeah, well, we're doing a little bit of a Montessori show right now. We're just free-forming it. We're just doing whatever we want. We're not even. But you were in the middle of making a point actually when we went to the break. But I cut you off only because I don't.
We don't want to stop corruption in the church from keeping us from becoming saints. If you look at the history of the church, many of the greatest saints rose up in times where there was a lot of corruption in the church and maybe even corruption at the level of the papacy. Don't let anybody else's lack of holiness or perceived lack of holiness stop you from being the saint you're meant to be. You know, you don't want to be Adam pointing to Eve and being like, oh, she started it. Yeah, like that. I like that we both had the same voice for Adam.
Yeah. Right, mopey Adam.
Yeah, like that's just not going to be an explanation that's going to get you very far at the Last Judgment if you didn't become the saint you're meant to be.
That's the thing. Focus on the Last Judgment a little bit. That clarifies the mind. Do you really want to stand before Jesus and go, you know what? I was so mad because I watched all these podcasts. Or do you want to be like, you know, I made sandwich and give them to poor people. You know,
right. I was uncharitable, but it was a really hot take.
Yeah. Well, Jesus will be like, all right, speaking of hot takes.
Take him to the hot place.
That was purgatory. I wasn't sending anybody to hell.
Oh, okay.
I just want to be clear. I was not consigning anyone to hell. All right. What are we doing? Should I do a video? Darren, tell me what to do. Do a video. All right. So everyone who has submitted these videos is a monthly donor to Catholic Answers. We're grateful for that. This one comes from James.
Hi, Joe. I was wondering how to work out what initiatives in apologetics and evangelism I'd need my bishop's permission to do and what things I could just get on with. Presumably, I don't need permission to evangelize someone, but what about writing an evangelistic tract or starting a network for people to evangelize together? Did you need permission from your bishop to start your blog, podcast, and YouTube channel? Could I avoid bothering my bishop about things like this by saying my resources aren't endorsed by the church hierarchy in a disclaimer? Thank you.
That's a great question. And I'm really glad people are asking this. This is one of those things where I think the changing media landscape is having a huge impact. In the old days, if you were going to write a book, you would send it off for a Neil Obstadt and an imprimatur before it was published. But you're not doing that before you write a blog post. You're not doing that before you put something out on Facebook or Instagram. That would be completely unworkable in terms of just the logistics of it. So this is something that has changed in some important ways. So I'd start with this. In terms of the proclamation of the gospel, at the most basic level, you have both the right and the duty to proclaim the gospel. Pope John Paul II has an entire encyclical, or actually apostolic exhortation about this, called Christi Fideli Laicis, which just means like the lay members of Christ's faithful people. And in it, he talks about how we are sent, and he is completely explicit that the laity are sent to proclaim the gospel. So you don't need the church's permission to do that. You have Christ's command. But if you needed it, the church and the person of the Pope is giving you both the permission and even ordering you to, saying you go to. That is the language he uses. So don't use "I'm not an officially approved church ministry" as a reason not to spread the gospel. Now, some of the more organized ways that can look may require the involvement of the church in a more institutional way. So there's a couple things. Number one, if you're going to use the name Catholic, you need permission from the church, and that can be something the bishop takes away. So, you know, tomorrow, if the Cardinal Archbishop of San Diego said, "I don't like Catholic Answers. I don't think it's doing a good job. I don't want them calling themselves Catholic," he could do that. And as an organization, we are canonically created. So we actually exist in canon law, not just in the same way that, like, if you're going to sell something on Facebook Marketplace, you don't need like articles of incorporation. But if you're going to become a business, you do. Well, similarly, if you're going to become like a Catholic apologetics group, then you need to be canonically enshrined in everything else. If you're going to do something like publish a book, it is not universally required that you have the Nihil Obstat and the Imprimatur. I think they're still good, but you really only need those if it's going to be something like a theology textbook or something of the sort. If you're just writing a book like "You Should Be Catholic," you can do that. It's still good to have like the eyes of somebody with authority on it to make sure that it's good quality. But you can create something where maybe your organization, like, you know, with Catholic Answers, we don't run every written product we have past the bishop. But he knows who we are and what we do, and is given the green light for us to pursue the ministry that we have. And we have several bishops who we're in consultation with, so that they know the general kind of work that we're doing here and can give us feedback too, that, you know, oh, this is good, this is not good. But we don't do typically like a prior approval process the way that was much more common in the past, just because it doesn't really work in the modern media landscape to wait, you know, 6 months on everything, as, you know, the diocesan delegate is looking over all of your products, that sort of thing. Now, some of that stuff is not my direct kind of realm. I would say with something like having a blog, I don't know of anyone who runs their blog posts or their YouTube channel by their bishop first. But hopefully, particularly if you're using anything that signals this is like the Catholic Church, that should definitely be something you're talking to your bishop about, or at least that he's aware of, so that if there's a problem, there's somebody with whom you can kind of talk about it. If you think about it this way, I'm going to use another business example. Every lawyer in the U.S. Is part of the bar of their particular state that they're practicing in. And one of the reasons is that if they're doing something really unethical or irresponsible, unprofessional, there's some recourse that an ordinary person who's hurt by them can have. And this works as well with businesses. You have Better Business Bureau. You have different states in which you're incorporated where, you know, you could have your business be legally dissolved if you do terrible enough stuff. Well, likewise, a group should have a way of being held accountable by the institutional church. And if they don't, then you run a risk of becoming like a parallel society from the church in a way that's not really spiritually healthy.
James, thank you very much for the question and for the support. Could you see that video or you just heard him?
Jump? I could see it.
You see what he had on the wall behind him? He had
Jeff
Cavins' Bible timeline. Nice. He's got the Bible timeline back up.
I didn't catch that. That's great.
Yeah. Jeff Cavins has done
a lot of
great work. I
interviewed Jeff Cavins. I find him very pleasant.
Oh, I feel like there's a pun here somewhere, but you're just actually saying. I felt like I was missing something. I'm so gun shy around you now, Joe. There's always a pun. Like, no, Jeff Cavins is a good man. But he's like a, you know, Father, the Bible in a Year.
Father Mike Schmitz.
Father Mike Schmitz.
I like that you know Jeff Cavins and not Father Mike Schmitz.
Well, it's not that I don't know Father. It's just that I get these brain cramps and they come on all of a sudden. But I think a lot of people.
I thought of the word acetaminophen and couldn't remember the word like Tylenol.
Thank you for sharing that. I was making a point, but.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm just kidding. I just think
it's
like
kind of caving in.
Okay, there's the Jeff Cavins. There it is. I knew he was going to have a Jeff Cavins pun. All I wanted to say is Jeff Cavins is the guy behind that whole Bible in a Year thing. He did that with Father Mike Schmitz and the two of them. And then they did Catechism in a Year. And I don't know what they're going to do in a year. What would be the next thing to do in a year? The
Talmud?
No, I'm just the kidding. Talmud? The Talmud in a year.
You could do like a Bible church writings. There's a lot out there.
Yeah, you could do encyclicals. You could do the social.
Probably not in a year, but yeah.
No, but we'd have to be selective, right? It wouldn't be like, yeah, I guess that's true. It would kind of be off-brand. But I just wanted to say they just did fantastic work. And
amen.
I like giving Jeff Cavins credit for that. And it's cool seeing the Bible timeline behind James. All right. Let's take a quick break. I'll get my act together. We'll come back and do some more questions for Joe on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Another great podcast on EWTN Podcast Central is The Catholic Man Show. Adam and David come together for a weekly discussion about faith, virtue, friendship, fatherhood, and other tools and gears needed to pursue holiness. You can hear The Catholic Man Show and other faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world, all in one place. all free at EWTN Podcast Central. Visit EWTN.com/radio and click on Podcast Central today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. All of our questions have come from our Society 315. And occasionally there will be puns thrown in whenever Joe is here. So listen for that. We think of them as Easter eggs here. They're little Easter eggs that Joe puts in there. And then I get gone. He says something perfectly normal, like, Jeff Cavins is a nice guy. And I'm like, where's the pun? No, actually, Jeff Cavins is just a nice guy. All right, Rhonda is a donor to Catholic Answers through Society 315, and she sent us this video.
Hi, my name is Rhonda. I'm from California. And my question is in regard to Mark chapter 9, verse 29. Jesus says, or they record that Jesus says, this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer and fasting. And I understand that there are those who believe that the last part about fasting might be a scribal entry. And so my question to you is, what is your opinion? Do you believe Jesus said that, prayer and fasting, or that it was a scribal entry? And I thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Rhonda.
That's a really good question. So that question gets into the weeds of comparing manuscripts. So you'll sometimes hear people say, oh, you know, the earliest and the best manuscripts don't have and fasting. They just have this kind cannot be driven out except with prayer. But the reality is, of, I think, 32 early manuscripts that the Nestle Aland 20th edition records, so this is like kind of the gold standard of comparing. This is a scholarly version of the Bible that has the New Testament with very detailed line by line, which manuscripts have which wording, and then it will highlight any discrepancies. And so on this one, it cites, I believe, 28 early manuscripts that have prayer and fasting, and only four that just have prayer. And of those four, three of the four are from the same textual family in Alexandria, which seems to me that there's a much stronger case that the original said prayer and fasting and the scribe forgot it and left it off, rather than that, you know, 28 different copies of the text have a scribal addition. It seems, you know, because there are times where you say, okay, you know, everybody but this manuscript over here says X, so probably X is right. In this case, you have something near that, where everybody except for four manuscripts says prayer and fasting. So it's not impossible, you know, for someone to argue the minority position is the original one. But I think many times people are just presupposing, oh, well, scholars are much more likely to add and fasting for their own theological reasons. When it's like, no, they could have just literally forgotten. You know, they're hand copying things. And when you're hand copying things, I've got text messages from the past week where I sent a message and forgot an important word in something I was dictating myself. It's not even uncommon to have those kind of scribal omissions, not for any reason other than really simple human error. So it seems to me you've got a pretty good case you can make for prayer and fasting, but I'm not like totally scandalized by somebody who thinks the original said prayer. Both prayer and fasting are good either way. And Jesus, in places like Matthew 6, talks about the spiritual need for prayer, fasting, and almsgiving.
So, Joe, if I could follow up Rhonda's question, what text then is the infallible or the inspired word of God? How do we decide what text is the inspired word of God?
Yeah, this is a very good question. It's sometimes described as the original autographs, like the original text as written. If you've got, in this case, 32. Different written accounts of what Jesus said, the original thing written, those 32 are recording, is what is divinely inspired. Now, God is preserving the transmission of his revelation. So we don't have to worry. Sometimes people imagine like a game of telephone where scribe number one gets the original, and then scribe number two hears it from scribe number one, and scribe number three gets it from scribe number two. It's not like that. It's rather that very early authors are looking at a wide collection of earlier authors when they're making translations. And so they might make a mistake here or there. It is not that we're claiming each translation is infallible or inerrant, or each new biblical printing. You know, you could get a new version of the Bible printed by the Vatican, say, and it might have a typo in it. That is not contrary to anything we believe about inerrancy or infallibility or inspiration. And so that's this process. The important thing to bear in mind as we talk about this, though, is that God is preserving his revelation. So the revelation is the unveiling. That's what the word revelation means, unveiling, the unveiling of God. And he unveils himself in Jesus Christ, and this is preserved in Scripture and is protected by the Holy Spirit. And not protected in a way to preclude typos, but protected in such a way that you're not going to, you know, become a heretic because you read one of the manuscripts that said prayer and not prayer and fasting. You're not going to, go to hell because you read the wrong manuscript or the wrong English translation or that. So we don't have something we consider to be like a divinely inspired English translation, the way what are called Ruckmanite KJV onlyists will claim the Holy Spirit inspired the KJV so that it corrects all the Greek. We don't buy that. We don't think that's true. That is completely made up. God never promises to do that. But instead, he does preserve his word in such a way that nothing of theological importance is going to hang on any of the minor discrepancies you're going to get between different translations.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Let me give you another question here from our Society 315. I'm just trying to remember where I am. And it is Alejandro who asks this: what prayer do you say, or any prayer, when you see crosses on the side of the highway?
I'll just say, may the souls of the faithful departed, through the mercy of God, rest in peace. I mean, because usually they're set up for those who have died. And so, you know, especially if I'm driving with my kids, we've really gotten in the habit of, when we're passing a cemetery or any kind of memorial for those who have died, acknowledging that and saying a quick prayer for them.
All right. Alejandro, excellent question. It's that prayer that you say, it is really something that the Catholic Church has a prayer for just about everything. If you need, there's nothing wrong with just spontaneously praying and sharing your prayer with the Lord. But if you need a prayer, the Catholic Church has got one for virtually.
Oh, I've got a cute story about this, if you don't mind. We went on Memorial Day to go pray in the cemetery. And while there, my daughter has this impulse to pray for the dead. She is four. And so she, we're used to doing that, the little prayer I just recited there, at the end of meal prayers. And so she goes over to the gravestone and starts going, "Bless us, O Lord," and these thy gifts.
Yep.
Because she knew there's a prayer for the dead at the end of that. And she didn't know you could do that one just by itself. So she was like, "Well, I guess I got to do the meal prayer and then get to the part about the souls of the faithful departed."
Yeah. Good for her.
Yeah. It was a very proud dad moment of like, oh, good. That was clever.
All right. Let's go to Catherine. Catherine, also a donor through our Society 315. Thank you, Catherine. Asked this question: are there spiritual dangers of apologetics? If so, what are they?
Yeah. I really like the way C.S. Lewis talks about it. He says in God in the Dock, I'm going to quote him here. He says, "I have found that nothing is more dangerous to one's own faith than the work of an apologist." Now, that is a striking kind of line.
Yeah.
He says, "No doctrine of that faith seems to me so spectral, so unreal, as one that I've just successfully defended in a public debate. For a moment, you see, it has seemed to rest on oneself. As a result, when you go away from that debate, it seems no stronger than that weak pillar. That is why we apologists take our lives in our hands and can be saved only by falling back continually from the web of our own arguments, as from intellectual counters, into the reality, from Christian apologetics into Christ himself. That is also why we need one another's continual help. Oremus pro invicem. Let us pray for one another." So yeah, I would say that's it. That is very easy when you've defended some doctrine to think of it as your own brilliance rather than, no, this is just like the truth of the matter. Yeah. And particularly if maybe some of your arguments weren't the greatest. You can defend a true thing with bad arguments. You can overstate your case. And then the more it feels like it rests upon your arguments and your reasoning, well, what if you find out one of your arguments is wrong? Then you can actually kind of undermine not just those who are hearing what you're saying, but even your own faith if you're not careful with it.
Catherine, thank you. Thank you very much for that question. I'm just trying to get as many as I can now. Jeff, also a donor through our Society 315. All the questions are from Society 315, our Giving Society today. And Jeff says this: "Hi, this is Jeff from Huntington, Tennessee. We know that God does not judge a person that is mentally unstable the same as others. What about that? What about people that have personalities, environmental situations, and inclinations that could be considered almost impossible to overcome, even within a lifetime of praying for those traits to end? Will they be judged the same at the end of their life?"
Yeah, this is a very good question. The short answer is no. God knows the hand you were dealt better than we do. Like, the field of mental health, for instance, is still very young. And so it's hard to know when something just a matter of you're making bad decisions and when is something like psychological compulsion or other neurological factors coming in. And it's, we can judge the behavior from the outside. We can't say the state of the interiority of the person, but God can. And so, you know, there is St. Mark G. Tianyang. I'm probably mispronouncing the Chinese there.
No, you couldn't. There's no way you're mispronouncing Chinese. I'm sure that that's a perfect pronunciation.
There's no way you're pronouncing it. Yeah, exactly. He died in the year 1900. He was one of the Chinese martyrs during the Boxer Rebellion. And he was an opium addict. And he did not want to be. He was fighting against it. But it wasn't like Opium Addicts Anonymous existed or there were any good resources to help him in that fight. And so his confessor was actually quite harsh on him in treating him as if he had just chosen not to do the right thing. So with all of these things, the Catechism has a couple different paragraphs talking about the factors that are going to be relevant in the morality of an action. So, and things like compulsion and acquired habit factor into that. Somebody who compulsively, yeah, I mean, if you want to stick with, uses opium, is less free and therefore somewhat less culpable when they're trying not to, as opposed to the person who just is like, yeah, I'm going to go smoke some opium now. I've never done it before, but it sounds like a good idea. That person is making a pretty free choice. Well, likewise with things like psychological factors, some of that stuff can be below the surface in a way that our neighbors judge unjustly, but God judges justly. In Mark 12:48, he says, "To whom much has been given, much will be expected. To whom more is given, more will be expected." Or when Jesus is before Pontius Pilate. Now, remember Pontius Pilate's situation. Pilate didn't choose to be involved in this whole situation with Jesus. He tried unsuccessfully to get out of the situation multiple times. He still sins, but he sins in the midst of tremendous pressure with a mob forming as he's fearing for his own status in life and everything else. So what he's doing is not okay. Jesus doesn't say it's okay. But Jesus does say in the Gospel of John that he would have no power unless it was given to him from on high. Therefore, the one who betrayed me is guilty of the greater sin. So Judas, who was under no compulsion to sin, who freely chooses to betray Christ, has done something for which he's more personally guilty than Pilate, who's also been involved. Both of them play a really important role in the death of Jesus, but one of them finds himself forced into a situation he handles badly. The other one chooses to be in the bad situation. So if you apply that in other areas of your life, there are things, and you don't want to let yourself off the hook too quickly. Sin needs to be eradicated, but be patient with yourself and recognize that God knows which things in your life you may be struggling with more than the outside world can see.
Jeff, thank you. A great question to end on this Labor Day weekend. We'll be back to do it again tomorrow, God willing. Joe Heschmeyer has been our guest. All of the questions today came from our Society 315 members. I'll just remind you again, if you'd like to become a monthly supporter of Catholic Answers, you can do that by just search Catholic Answers Society 315. A page will come up, or you can just go to givecatholic.com. Check out Joe Heschmeyer's podcast. A new episode, well, several episodes a week drop. Go to shamelessjoe.com. Thank you, Joe Heschmeyer.
Oh, my pleasure.
All right. That'll do it for us. We'll do it tomorrow, as I said, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.